a friend of mine who was writing about Braid, who'd seen Braid at GDC, sent John my webcomic, I guess. I think that's how it happened, or got us in touch. But the webcomic was essentially my portfolio for Braid. So there was some kind of something in the comic that was felt close enough in spirit to Braid, I think. And I felt that way going into Braid, that there was some continuity and theme or approach or something like that.
Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of the Braid Anniversary Podcast. This time we're switching it up a bit. Our interviewee is David Hellman, who is the primary visual artist of the game. And when I say visual artist, that's always a little bit awkward because, you know, in the games industry, we just call the person who does the graphics for the game the artist. So David is the primary artist on the game, you would say. But I don't like that terminology because I think game design is art, and it's a very important art. In fact, it's central to what games really are. So, you know, why should visual art get the entire moniker of art for itself? And so I tend to say visual artist just as my own particular eccentricity. Anyway, David was the primary visual artist on the game. Some other artists worked on the game, and David will talk about that. Most notably, Edmund McMillan did early animations and character designs that David then modified. David's going to talk about how he got started working on the game and how he developed the style that is so recognizable today. So let's get into it.
I'm ashamed.
What are you ashamed of, David?
I don't know. This game, this... If I'm trying... I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed. Take it back.
You really backtracked on that. What are you not telling me?
This is an interesting thing to like explain work I did a long time ago.
Okay.
It's cool. I'm happy about it. I feel very fortunate about Braid overall.
Yeah.
That it's been a really good thing for me. But it's also kind of it just feels lucky. I guess I think of Braid as something that was very successful in the context of my life. And like people talk about it like it mattered. And so I feel both proud, but also like that's just really lucky. Like there's always some distance. There's always like a gap between having done a thing and then like however it's received or exists in the world and other people knowing about it. And that so it's unique in my life as a thing that people know about more than I expect sometimes.
Do you think that... you know, you kind of mentioned that it kind of has a life on its own outside of, you know, your experience with it. And,
yeah.
And when you say you're ashamed that you feel lucky that, you know, is this just kicking yourself and saying that like my work's not important, or is it that like where's that coming from?
Yeah, I don't want to be overwrought, like I'm sort of kidding around, but I guess there's some like ambivalent feeling or kind of two-sided feeling because maybe it's the other side of like feeling proud is feeling modest.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you are proud.
Yeah. And I think I feel most comfortable if I'm talking about the decision-making and the work and feeling creatively excited, then I really like talking about it.
Okay.
But I'm also proud that like it was successful and that like if I just met somebody upstairs and didn't bring up that I, you know, I met like an artist,
mm-hmm.
a game artist. And I said, yeah, I'm like working on, I did an indie game or something. And then was it you? You came over. Was it? Yeah, you're right there. Because there's another time Tom came over and the same thing happened where someone else came over and said like, he's not telling you he did Braid. And that's happened to me a bunch, you know, and that's what people do also. Like that's what people do when you're talking to people in your industry and people know of each other's projects, you know, but, it's not like I'm in some random bar somewhere and it's like, oh, Braid isn't that famous, but there's still that sense that I do feel proud that I made something that's important enough, I guess, or was like effective enough as a product that we're now doing this.
Yeah.
Much later. So I feel like a sense of pride and also a sense of like security and kind of like, I feel like I've received enough praise in my life to feel most, I don't know, fairly secure, which doesn't always work, but yeah.
On that subject then, let's kind of go back to original Braid.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, I met you post Braid. I don't know that it was like out yet, but it was like I had played it somewhere the first time I met you. So I didn't know David pre-Braid, but who was David Hellman, you know, like at the start of Braid, right? Like, I know you're an artist, but, you know, what was your medium? What were you doing at that time?
I was pretty fresh out of art school in Baltimore, where I grew up. And I'd been doing a webcomic called A Lesson Is Learned but the Damage Is Irreversible with my friend Dale Baran, who's a writer. And I was interested in games. I'd worked on some games in college with a friend, some prototypes, I mean. But I was pretty far removed from like any actual industry activity or like viable indie development. It was just kind of hobbyist stuff in an art school context. And I really didn't want to get a job. Dale and I both felt that way, and we were doing our comic as a way to forestall that. Like, hopefully we would just make something we would own completely on our own terms and then make a lot of money off of that and never have to get jobs. That was the goal, but we didn't have the business sense to pull that off. I mean, I was selling posters that I was printing at home, and it was just not, the volume wasn't there, and my kind of turnaround wasn't there. So it was, you know, paying for some of our costs, but not much more. And then John Blow, a friend of mine who was writing about Braid, who'd seen Braid at GDC, sent John my webcomic, I guess. I think that's how it happened, or got us in touch. But the webcomic was essentially my portfolio for Braid. So there was some kind of something in the comic that was felt close enough in spirit to Braid, I think. And I felt that way going into Braid, that there was some continuity and theme or approach or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind for me when I think of the two back to back is surely just, you know, informed by the fact that it's your art, but there's definitely a tonal connection.
Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I actually struggle to come up with the adjectives to describe that tone, but I'm wondering if you know what they might be.
I think the comic, A Lesson Is Learned, like Braid, I think we were struggling with just messy stuff about human feelings, kind of personal feelings, romantic feelings, some yearning, sometimes literally like a romantic desire, and sometimes just a kind of discomfort in the world, like an existential uncertainty or something. So some feeling of incompleteness, kind of high level airy stuff, like emotional stuff, and, you know, not like survival angst, but feelings. And then the artistic expression itself being a way of engaging with that. I think like the comic took many forms visually. Like we were restless and changed it up a lot. And that's part of what made it really fun, that we never had to just like be production line style and do a bunch of the same thing. It was always evolving a bit and exploring. And that kind of search and like shifting, I think, had something to do with trying to resolve irresolvable things that you're feeling, you know, and also having fun with it, like enjoying the possibilities. And yeah, Braid, I think, is also about some kind of hard to, some kind of search that's hard to exactly explain, but some kind of existential search or search for like the truth of the world, accessed through one's own senses and thoughts, which are unreliable. And And also some kind of romantic search, the kind of searching for some attachment that would be significant or profound or complete the picture somehow. And kind of reshaping the world, reshaping your world as experienced through your senses and thoughts. So kind of the way the style of the comic changed, the world of Braid is in the process of being created. That's what we wanted to come across, that it feels like it's being made in front of you and it's alive and it's like you're seeing a painting being painted in front of you, but you're inside of it. That was the idea.
So where is that idea coming from, you know, maybe thematically with Braid? Like what, when you're expressing visually this idea of a painting coming to life in front of you and you inhabiting that space, what to your mind is it that is tying into maybe the narrative or the theme of Braid that you're expressing through that?
Well, I think Tim, the main character in Braid, is trying to answer questions in his life, and he's doing it actively through an act of creation, or maybe even thinking about it as an act of creation, because his thoughts become his world, the thoughts he constructs around himself that he needs to kind of parse what's going on. And so there's a kind of solipsistic aspect, maybe, like, you know, I mean, I think we all, you know, interface the world through our own perceptions and everything. But I think in Braid, it's a very conscious, overt thing where it's supported in the narrative too, that he's like, has a creative power in the world and he's sort of trying different experiments to see if he can understand the world better. So there's a creative, don't know if I'm answering your question directly, but the art, the living painting idea reflects Tim's creativity in trying to create a world, create a framework that will allow him to have like that authentic encounter with the world. But he has to build that himself. It's not, I guess he can't just access it directly. It has to be discovered or he has to build some scaffolding towards it.
So when there's, for example, maybe pieces of, you know, real world that are maybe like morphed and skewed within Braid's world, right? Like I'm thinking of furniture and like the house, like yeah. When there's props like that, you know, is that Tim trying to sort of build a framework with what he understands in, let me rephrase that. Is that Tim sort of like grasping at what he already knows and understands in order to like build a new framework for sort of building this, I don't know, this new way of connecting, I guess.
You're asking if the,
well, like I mean, what role does that stuff play? You know what I mean? Like, uh-huh. Because it's not just, you know, I'm thinking of, I don't know what world, I think it's 5 or 6 where it's, you know, there's just
the
like
furniture and the
giant drawers and like that to me as an observer is like, that's something from Tim's real world. That's sort uh-huh. of like dreamlike being painted into, you know, whatever he's got going on right now. Like what were you going for by incorporating those things?
Yeah. Well, the scenery in each world reflects the themes of the world, which relate to Tim's particular state of mind and particular focus and everything. So in 5, world 5 is about the question of staying or going. And world 5 explores two different outcomes from that fork, from that decision. So when you rewind, the last thing you did plays forward, but you're now existing in a parallel world. So it's first implemented in the game play, in the game systems, And then the puzzles engage with that idea, that reality, that created reality, created by the programmer and designer, of two worlds that do, in fact, in front of you, exist in parallel. And then, so then the art tries to engage with that motif, both, I guess, as a formal thing, but also emotionally. So if it's about staying or leaving, I want to represent both of those ideas. So we have a lot of domestic objects, like the drawers and the comfy pillows and stuff. They're not, they need to look really comfortable and nice. Like, what a nice duvet, what a nice sofa. This pillow has a lot of texture on it, these beautiful old books. So there's a sense of value in them. But then they're all out in a swamp. They're all out in the water and they're obviously deteriorating. They're in piles, so they're not well cared for anymore. So there's a contradiction that I'm just trying to turn into a visual. But I mean, hopefully it's sort of intuitive. It might feel kind of weird, but then it gives your mind something to like play with while you're also doing the puzzles.
So when you're talking about these themes for different worlds and you know, the visual elements that you use to visualize, I guess, those themes, right? Are these ideas that were presented to you in a fully formed way, or were you able to contribute creatively to Braid beyond just the visual looks of it?
I got to contribute. Yeah. The way it started was John explained the theme of each world. And I remember the first email, and it was just about this. And there was literally a list of like world two, world three, world four, like one line about each. I mean, he would elaborate on it more, but I did start from just a very simple direction of, you know, the idea of, and I'd have to look at what that was to say exactly, but it might've been like the idea of staying or going, world two, which is the first one, confusingly, being, having a sense of possibility and adventure and optimism and feeling the most sort of normal as like a Green Hills game area, you know, and then the world following that, world three, having an increased sense of like magic to it, but also danger. And forward from there. So it's just kind of like a very simple direction. And then, yeah, I had room to play. There might have been cases where he had a specific thing he wanted, but I definitely had room to explore.
Did you contribute in a game design sense at all, or were you strictly limited to visuals?
I did get to contribute the design a little bit, and I was happy about that. I remain proud of it because I only recently started working with John, and it was all remote over email. So, you know, but I was excited. So I didn't know this guy, but I was excited that we were doing this thing together, and it was a great job for me to have at the time. And John was trying to figure out how to visually justify, how to make it intuitive that there are moving cloud platforms that disappear and then reappear somewhere else, kind of looping. They're just moving platforms that have to loop from kind of arbitrary positions. And he actually emailed me and some of his designer friends, and there were a bunch of ideas, and I had the best idea, which was to use something that already existed, which were the cannons. There were already two kinds of cannons, cannons that shoot fireballs, which is what you would expect, and cannons that shoot monsters. So there was already an idea that cannons can shoot non-obvious things. And so the cloud was just another extension of that, the cloud cannon. And that way you have the cloud itself is the visual starting point of the cloud. And when the cloud hits an object, hits a wall, it will disperse, and then the cannon will fire again. So, yeah, it was just like kind of an elegant solution.
As a former producer, I very much appreciate the recycling of concepts.
Yeah.
What was the state of the game when you first got involved?
When I first got involved, the game was functionally complete. It would change in some ways after that, but it was fully playable and looked done, except that the art wasn't there. Well, there was some art. John had actually hired some, I think he hired a firm which had assigned some artists to the project, but then they were taken off of it because of another client, essentially. And they were, the art that was there had, if I remember right, it had, it wasn't like photoreal, but it had kind of more towards a realistic children's book illustration style, I think. And I remember like logs and forest scenes, and the scale was different. Like the logs were very large, like it made Tim look like a little bug or something. And everything else was like tall grasses and logs and twisty trees and stuff. And actually that kind of, that had some influence on me. Like I took that as a cue to do trees, which I like drawing trees anyway, but then large parts of the game were just like, without art, like, just like bounding boxes or like simple, like volumes with a repeated texture or whatever. Edmund McMillan, of Super Meat Boy, Binding of Isaac fame and others, was working on the game and had done character sprites. So, the character sprites were quite far along, maybe finished. And so that was, that didn't stay, but they remained influential. Like I ended up working over them. So in some cases they remain very much the look of the characters.
Does that include Tim? Like, did you design Tim or did you just refine him?
I refined Tim. Edmund's characters that remain very close are like the greeter dinosaur at the end of the worlds, the claw or the plant that comes out of the pipe. The rabbit is pretty close. The monster creature, the sort of Goomba, like round guy that walks, was redrawn a lot, but used like kind of reused frame by frame. So I think like the way the feet move are exactly how Edmund did them, I think. And then Tim, I changed the look fully. Like the face is totally different. The head, the proportions are a little different, but I think it was based on all of his framework. So it, probably the way he moves is Edmund's work.
When you're drawing Tim, is he a real person to you? Is that a person in your head?
No. I try to give him John's cheekbones.
Is that right?
Yeah. I think that's all though.
So do you think of him as autobiographical John, or do you just think of him as a video game generic sprite?
I think of him as having elements of John just because the game was John's game. But I don't know. He's his job is to be like the game character. So he's like, he's Jumpman. He's the guy who's in there doing that stuff. And like, he's emotive, but not to the full breadth of like what the story would imply or demand. So he's more of like a cipher for the player. He's like there to be the game character. And I think there's some interesting tension between like the amount of depth or kind of like emotional range suggested by the story, by the parts you read before the worlds, and the way Tim looks, because he's not as emotive as he doesn't have the burden of like acting all these different shades and facets. He's like a game character.
On that note, your personal life before this, before Braid, what was your relationship to 2D platformers? Was that a kind of game that you enjoyed prior to this?
Yeah. I grew up on Nintendo games. Let's see. I mean, there's a lot of Mario references. So yeah, that absolutely was loomed large for me.
So when you're, for example, thinking about, you know, animation frames, like turnaround frames, jumping frames, are you mostly drawing from Super Mario?
You know, well, I mean, again, a lot of the animation was already prototyped by Edmund or fully drawn by Edmund, but it ended up being treated as a prototype because I painted over. But those are his poses in general. But there is a way that like Tim's look is Mario-like. I mean, he's wearing a suit, which I think, I mean, you know, thinking about it now, I'm having like surprising thoughts because the, what I was going to say about it was Mario is like a game archetype. He's just sort of like a game character. And then Tim is sort of taken in a more realistic real world direction. Like he's wearing a suit, so he's like a real guy. But I don't know if that makes any sense. I mean, Mario's wearing overalls because he's a plumber. He's just blue collar, and then Tim is like the white collar. So I think it's probably truer to say that, not that like Tim is a realistic Mario, but he's just the white collar Mario. He's like the, he's a PMC Mario. He's professional class Mario.
There's rabbits in this game.
Yep.
You foster rabbits.
Yeah.
That's the question.
We have rabbits, but that happened much later.
Okay, so no connection.
No.
In your art style.
No, no, no. In fact, I would have drawn the rabbits differently if I'd had rabbits when I was working on Braid.
Okay. I'll let that water. There we go. What would you change about the rabbits now that you foster rabbits if you were starting from scratch?
That's a really good question. I have like a very much richer and personal sense of what is cute about rabbits. So I would definitely have captured more of the expressions of our rabbits and their body shape probably.
Would you have kept them as vicious as they are?
Yes, I think so.
Tell me about art school. What did you study in art school?
I was a general fine arts major, which gave me the most flexibility, which is very much in keeping with my whole like avoid a job, avoid obligations stuff, and do things that I want to do. So that let me do, I did a lot of studio art classes and I was grounded in like real materials. I was very interested in like charcoals and paint and stuff like that, which I hadn't done a lot before. So that influenced me a lot. Even though I would end up working mostly digitally, like Braid is all digital art and everything I do now. But that experience of working with real materials changed how I worked because it's much more fluid and like you're like molding and sculpting sometimes, you know, like as a kid, I would draw mostly with markers and you just have to kind of anticipate the page well enough to like put the lines down with a strategy of like building up from, you know, you kind of pre-visualize it enough and then you build up with some strategy to like assemble things and leave the enough room for everything and put the focal point where you want and everything. But with materials like charcoal and oils, they can evolve. You can go over and move them around a lot. So I got very interested in that whole process and felt that it reflected in some way like the complexity of like being a human or something that we were trying to capture in the comic, A Lesson Is Learned, and that I felt was relevant in Braid, that life involves a kind of messy search for the right shape of things. And you're gonna try something and then wipe it out or go over it again, or there'll be surprises and discoveries as you go, and you'll find yourself doing something by engaging with that confusion and that mess. You'll find something you wouldn't have found otherwise. So you're not always able to pre-visualize and just go indirectly. Not that doesn't also involve discovery and responding to what's in front of you. It does, but I got interested in that messy process.
So in that process, I mean, does that messy approach allow for, like, say, happy accidents?
For sure, yeah. You're bound to have happy accidents. And I like things that are irregular too. So sometimes you end up, you know, sometimes I literally make a mess, like just make some scribbles and then start to draw over them. And then I'm forced to focus in a way that I'm seeing the new thing I'm putting down and kind of filtering out the thing that it's on top of. But then it gets incorporated surprisingly sometimes. So I may only cover like half the canvas, but the half that's showing through is now serving the thing that went on top kind of by accident. But then I allow it to exist.
Were there any elements that come to mind in Braid that you weren't visualizing when you started throwing the digital paint down that just sort of like materialize themselves out of the marble.
Well, you said out of the marble. That reminds me of a quote. Isn't that the Michelangelo quote? That, or did you know that? Oh, I thought that's why you said out of the marble. But there is a quote from Michelangelo, I think, or at least a saying about him.
Oh, that, sure. I mean, that is what I was drawing.
Yeah, on. Yeah, yeah. That yeah. He would see the figure in the block of marble and free it.
And that's what I'm thinking of when you're describing this mess process and that sort of carving away at it.
But that quote, I don't know. I haven't heard like discussions of that, but that suggests to me almost more of like a sense of that the final form is kind of fated or dictated somehow. Like it's already there and he just has to reveal it. And marble is so like hard and doesn't move around. So once you chip something off, it's basically done. But that's so different from like from messy painting where you're pushing things around back and forth and there's no like definite endpoint. It's just like you could work it forever. You don't run out of marble to chip off. I don't know if I answered your question though.
I think you did.
Okay.
I think you did. So you had done some, let's say, amateur game development.
Yeah.
Before Braid. Are there like Braid looking prototypes that, you know what I mean? Like that you worked on? Like, is there any sort of similarities between Braid and your past game prototypes?
I don't think so. I don't remember. The things that I can think of now look very different. Like I remember working in like black and white, low res pixel art and doing 16-bit style art and even doing some 3D stuff, which I remain a beginner in all that, but you know, building like some kind of 3D castle and having a critter run around. So probably nothing like Braid.
Having a hard time visualizing 3D art from you, to be honest.
It's just like a Minecraft type thing. Like,
got it.
Blocky, but I do like space and designing spaces and the feeling of being inside of a thing or you've gone outside or on top of it and all that stuff.
Yeah, that I'm having an easy time imagining for sure, just based on, you know, things like Second Quest, right? Uh-huh. Like that's definitely you. Do you feel that there were other artists you were tapping into when drawing Braid?
Yeah, I always cite Paul Cézanne. Definitely his work definitely had a huge impact on me and I've looked at it a lot. I really liked how they're probably just some like formal similarities I could point out, like the way he constructs things with a lot of regular brush strokes, that many of them are kind of close in size and shape and it's just like a lot of strokes, but he's also building with like a very strong sense of geometry, and I do that in some way, but there's also to me like a vibrancy in the way he combines colors. And I just have a feeling that his work has a search about it. Like he's searching for something beautiful and ordered for him. And the way he handles contours and shapes, they kind of shimmer. It's kind of like there's a vibration to it. So things aren't like locked in completely firmly, like they're like marble. It has a kind of shimmeriness to it, like the way, which feels like perceptual to me, like the way your head moves around side to side a little bit. And therefore things are kind of all hovering around more than, you know, being completely reliable and solid. I think that kind of hovering feeling is also feels somehow related to, I don't know, just that's just how life is. Like things are kind of, things shift and are a bit unreliable, but you try to keep your bearings.
It's interesting. This is, you know, maybe the second or third time this theme has come up in this conversation of kind of searching for truth through art, right? I mean, is this something that, you know, I feel that from the game design as well, from the narrative, right? I mean, is this something that you think maybe connects you and Jonathan?
Yeah, I think that was a similarity that made me feel at home with the project very quickly.
Yeah. And it's something that, you know, is it something that, well, actually this was the next question I was going to ask was, what did you think of the game when you got it? Were you like, oh, this is a cool game, I'm really excited to work on this? Or what was your perception of the game when it came in?
I thought the game was cool. I thought it was clever. I thought it had integrity. Like I could tell, you know, because he would talk about this, but it was also obvious in the game that it really gets to the point. You know, it's doing something interesting and it's self-aware and focused. And so it's not like larding it up with a lot of tropes and kind of trinkets and things. So it's, you know, John would always say this game values your time. So yeah, it felt like something intentional and cool and intelligent. Like there was some, but you know, it also felt like, I think this may be retrospective more than how I felt at the time. I don't know, but it did feel also like the natural thing for someone to do, because even though I was living in Baltimore and just kind of engaging online and stuff like that, I think there was a sense that games were ready to become more personal and to use some established forms and formats to be more introspective or philosophical, that kind of thing. Like I remember kind of applying that to even a Zelda game, like talking about the light world and the dark world as having some kind of, I remember actually my friends laughed at me because I was getting too highfalutin about it. But like, you know, the idea that there's a world and then there's like a symbolic world behind it that reflects some truth. Like I just thought games can do all this stuff, you know, but if you strip away the stuff that just feels very like genre tropey and kind of put in some signifiers to kind of hint that it's okay for people to think about it more deeply, then they'll start to have a more profound experience with it.
So, okay. So you were in Baltimore, working remotely over email. When you were working on Braid, where did you do that physically?
I was in my parents' house. I'd finished art school and I'd moved back to my parents' house, which was nearby. And I don't remember what I was planning at the time. I tend not to plan very much. So if I have something to do that, you know, if I'm doing a creative project and I'm okay in the present, I focus on that. So it's possible I was just living there and got this Braid gig and was doing that for a while. And then it didn't take long to start that I started to think about moving to San Francisco. I did want to leave Baltimore, but yeah, that's where I was at the time.
When you do Braid art, then and or, you know, other than like original or anniversary, I mean, is there a particular like mode that you have to put yourself in?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly, yeah, I'm sure there is, but I might have to like conjure it. But I guess there would be like some emotional mode, but definitely like a technique mode.
Mm.
Like the way I painted Braid. Actually, I don't do that anymore because it's too time consuming. Like I mentioned, a lot of little brush strokes. So it's a very inefficient way to paint, actually. It's just kind of crawling over everything with like a small brush. It's not the smallest, you know, but it's a lot of individually placed. It's like a lot of stippling and poking and, you know, a lot of sampling. What I would do was work with kind of work with one brush a lot of the time, and that changed a bit which one I was using, but I'd work with one brush that was like a round brush with a very simple shape, or maybe like a little bit of texture, a little bit of grain on it, or like sometimes I was using a brush with a canvas texture that a lot of people noticed in the original Braid. I'm using one brush and its opacity is set to like 60 to 75%. And as I go, I'm sampling with the eyedropper. So I'm sampling locally, painting transparently, and then sampling again. So I'm getting more subdivisions of color. And so that's kind of how I worked on it.
And when you revisited it, did you go back to your old techniques to make sure you were sort of being true to Braid, or did you have new techniques to come up with sort of similar aesthetics?
I think I did largely the same thing. I was working, actually I did the new Braid art mostly in Procreate on my iPad, which I was using for a long time. So a little bit different workflow, but yeah, very similar ultimately.
Thanks for listening to the Braid Anniversary Podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode. What'll be in it, we don't even know yet. But till then, enjoy life. In this episode, Frank Cifaldi asked the questions, David Hellman answered the questions, Jason Brisson produced, and Will Torbett edited. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.